or go online to CITR.ca. CITR's charts are based on actual spins motivated by actual preference. No payola, no marketing, just good tunes. Refreshing, no?
I'm Danny Wood, the backup anchor for Free Speech Radio News.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Today is Monday, June 25th. I'm Chirag Mahajan.
And I'm Claire Eagle. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia, to our UBC campus, to residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It is 5:05 and time for another full hour of independent news. Our headlines will cover news from the UBC campus, local news from Metro Vancouver, federal news from across Canada, as well as news from around the world. We also have your weekly Dietitian Intuition, where they talk about Men's Health Week and prostate cancer. And we will be talking to Edgar Morales from Latin Couver's upcoming event, Carnival del Sol.
All this plus your weekday weather forecast right here on News 101, your source for independent news. So right now we're joined by Edgar Morales from Carnival del Sol. So Edgar, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So, first of all, we know that Carnival del Sol is coming up this weekend, but can you tell us a bit about the event?
Sure. The event will take place this Saturday, June 30th, from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. on Granville Street. We'll be covering from Smythe all the way down to Hastings. And we want to invite all your listeners to come and join us.
Great. So what kind of things can our listeners expect to see at the street festival?
Well, we're going to have food from all over Latin America. We're going to have soccer. There's going to be Zumba. There's going to be some dance instructors there as well. And there's going to be over 50 performances in two different stages. We're also going to have a fashion show.
Well, that sounds like a lot of fun. So can you tell us a bit about Carnival del Sol? Like, how long has it been going on for?
Well, Carnival del Sol has been around for about 4 years. The first 2 years, it was a smaller event. Mm-hmm. Last year was our first event, our first year on Granville Street. Mm-hmm. We actually had over 40,000 people, and this year is going to be a big event right on Granville Street again.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I know this is put on by Latin Couver. So what exactly is Latin Couver?
Latin Couver is a nonprofit organization. We're trying to bring together not only the Latino community, but the local community as well. Mm-hmm. And we organize different kind of events in sustainability. We're also organizing the Latin American Business and Expo Trade. And we do a lot of other events around the city.
And so you mentioned a lot of other events. Are these usually attended only by like Latin Americans, or is it for the Vancouver community as well?
No, these are all for the Vancouver community as well. We want to include everybody, so that our name is Latin Coover, so the Coover part includes everybody, so we want everyone to feel welcome. Mm-hmm. We have people in our team from all different nationalities as well.
Mm-hmm. And how did Latin Coover start?
It actually started by Paola Murillo. She's the founder, and she actually also got an award as being one of the 10 Hispanic most influential in Canada. So she started this organization with the idea of building a plaza. So in Latin America, we have this thing called plazas, which is how cities were built around a plaza, which is a place where people come together.
Mm-hmm.
So it was started as a plaza online.
Mm-hmm.
But now our idea is to eventually one day have a plaza where people in Vancouver can come together and share some time with friends, with family, music, mm-hmm. food.
And I guess the Carnaval de Sol is obviously quite a good step in that it gets people out. It really gets people on the street and enjoying some of the weather, enjoying the food, and so on.
Our main objective is just to bring people together and to just, you know, share our music or culture or art as well. And also, you know, like it's summertime right now, so this would be a good way to start the summer.
And, I mean, it seems to me, at least, that there's this big growth of sort of street festivals in Vancouver. I know we just had Greek Day yesterday, and I think we've got Italian Days coming up. So why do you think that it's important to bring this idea of the plaza and having people out on the street and hanging out? Why do you think that's important in Vancouver?
Just bringing a sense of community. Vancouver is a very multicultural city, and then we're all different communities here represented. So by having these festivals, we're not only exposing the different cultures of the city, but we're also all coming together and sharing. Like, I was down on Commercial Drive for Italian Day, so it was just amazing to see like just the music and just the atmosphere. Same thing on Greek Day yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
Just, you know, people coming together and just sharing, you know, the culture, the food, and doing it in Vancouver, a place where you can, you know, be whoever you want and share your traditions, your culture with friends and family.
Yeah, that sounds great. Just for our listeners, what are some key highlights that you think they shouldn't miss at Carnaval del Sol?
Definitely, or we had the first part of our soccer tournament yesterday, so the semifinal and the final for the Latin Coover, the Copa Latin Coover will be this Saturday. So that will be a big highlight event. We're going to have Zumba throughout the day, so if a lot of your listeners like to do some Zumba, so they can come as well. Check out the food, all the performances. Mm-hmm. I couldn't give you one in specific. We're actually going to have Will Campa, which is he's quite well known, so he's got a lot of fans in Vancouver. So he actually will be closing the show.
Wow, that's great. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today.
Thank you for having me. I will see you guys all this Saturday 30th on Grand Street for Carnaval del Sol.
Sounds great. See you then. Bye-bye.
Bye.
So once again, that was Edgar Morales from Latin Coover presenting Carnaval del Sol, which is going to be a great street festival happening this Saturday from 10 a.m. till 10 p.m. on Granville Street between Smythe and West Hastings. So if you are free and hopefully weather permitting, it's beautiful out, come on down and grab some food and dancing and have fun with that. So now it's time to go on to our local headlines.
On Friday, June 22nd, UBC celebrated the members of its community participating in the 2012 London Olympics. UBC will be represented by as many as 14 athletes, 3 coaches, and a number of sports doctors and staff. Since 1928, where UBC's Harry Warren participated in track and field at the Amsterdam Olympics, more than 240 UBC Olympians and Paralympians have brought home 119 medals. A couple of interesting facts about our UBC Olympians. UBC's most decorated Olympian is Kathleen Heddle, with 3 gold and 1 bronze in rowing. Rowing itself has the highest all-time UBC representation of all sports. 73 UBC athletes have brought home 44 medals in rowing. UBC's most decorated Paralympian is Walter Wu, whose 16 medals in swimming include 8 gold.
The University of British Columbia and Helen Keller International of Cambodia have received a $2.9 million grant from the Canadian International Food Security Research Fund for research to increase and diversify food production and nutrition for small rural households in Cambodia. Cambodia produces enough rice to feed its population, but maternal and child undernutrition remains high due to a lack of crop diversity and shortage of nutrient-rich food. The study, led by UBC researchers Tim Green and Judy McLean, will examine how farmers can combine aquaculture and home gardens to produce more affordable and nutritious food and gain the tools they need to improve agricultural practices and nutrition.
UBC is continuing its focus on sustainability with two new degree programs, the Bachelor of Science in International Nutrition and the Master's in Clean Energy. The BSc in International Nutrition is the first degree of its kind in North America, said Judy McLean, an assistant professor in the Faculty of Land and Food Systems. Dr. McLean, who helped develop the program, said that students will work on projects with organizations like UNICEF to gain experience in an international setting. McLean said the program is restricted to approximately 20 students. The other program, a Master's of Clean Energy, started in 2009 and has 45 graduates. Though primarily an engineering program, the curriculum includes elements of environmental science, political science, economics, psychology, business, and public policy.
Two incoming first-year students, Cassandra Elphinstone and Jenai Lai, will receive $60,000 each over 4 years from the Schulich Leader Scholarships Program to study at the University of British Columbia. Announced in the fall of 2011, the Schulich Leader Scholarships Program recognizes students across Canada who demonstrate excellence in academics and community leadership and plan to study in science, technology, engineering, or mathematics during their undergraduate degree. Elphinstone and Lai were selected from a pool of Schulich Leader nominees who applied their nomination to UBC. Every Canadian high school, secondary school, and cégep could nominate one student each to be eligible to receive the scholarship. In 2012, 40 students were awarded scholarships out of 977 nominees.
30 First Nations youths are throwing together an emergency fundraiser to help pay for their annual summer canoe trip after federal budget cuts yanked $100,000 from their program. Members of the Renfrew Collingwood Aboriginal Canoe Club will hold a silent auction of their own artworks and crafts on Thursday to replace some of the lost funds. The group of teens and young adults spend time on weekends and some weekday evenings training for a 9-day camping and saltwater canoe trip, in addition to learning traditional arts in classes funded by the Cultural Connections for Aboriginal Youth Program. The Federal Treasury Board froze funding for the $22 million program last week, cutting off $100,000 in funds to Renfrew Collingwood's program, retroactive to April 1st. According to Collingwood Neighbourhood House Executive Director Jennifer Gray Grant. While some Aboriginal programs have simply shut down, the Neighbourhood House has been pulling funds from other programs to keep the canoe trip alive. And that does it for our UBC campus and local headlines here on News 101. We're going to take a quick break, but do stay with us for your local weather forecast as well as your provincial and international headlines.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
What do you know about bikes? Everything? Perfect. Nothing at all? Even better. At the UBC Bike Kitchen, you can use our space and tools to do your own bike maintenance, get one-on-one instruction on how to fix your bike yourself, or drop your bike off for us to repair. You can also buy a fully refurbished, guaranteed used bicycle, or a variety of new and used parts and accessories. The Bike Kitchen is UBC's non-profit, student-owned, full-service bike shop. We're located in the basement of the Student Union building. Just look for the stairwell on the north side of the sub across from Gage Towers, or search for the UBC Bike Kitchen on Facebook. Stop by the Bike Kitchen and then get riding.
and welcome back to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM. My name is Claire Eagle, and we're broadcasting to you live from the Student Union Building here at the University of British Columbia. It's now time for your provincial and national headlines.
22 people are facing charges after a clash with police following Fête Nationale festivities north of Montreal. Regional police in Bois de Filon say two officers were injured when police tried to break up fights in a crowd late Sunday. The incidents broke out as local celebrations marking Quebec's provincial holiday were winding down and people refused to leave the park. Captain Sylvain Thiret says bottles, rocks, and even garbage cans were thrown at his officers by some in the mob of 500 people. Riot squads from the Quebec Provincial Police and nearby Laval were called in to help, and it took about 3 hours to get the situation under control. Thiret says the people arrested will face charges of participating in a riot, armed assault, obstructing a police officer, and making threats. One police officer was treated in hospital for injuries to his head and another for a wound on his leg. Both have been released from hospital. Thiret says there were also some minor injuries among those arrested.
Hundreds of British Columbians are away from their homes. Others are without clean drinking water, and one person is dead after a weekend of heavy rain flooded homes and washed away roads in several areas of the province. Weeks of rapid snowmelt and wet weather have caused river levels to rise in the BC interior, the Kootenay region, and the Fraser Valley, and a weekend of heavy rain and violent thunderstorms have pushed many rivers and creeks in those areas to the brink. Hardest hit was Sicamous, a community of 3,100 people north of Kelowna, where about 350 people were ordered to leave their homes due to flooding along the Sicamous and Hummingbird Creeks. At least one home was swept away, and many more homes and dozens of cars were damaged after flash floods tore through Sicamous, where the local district declared a state of emergency. One resident said, quote, "It's a total state of total devastation and disaster. Parts of the bank were just falling off in chunks. We lost all of our backyard, and now it's just boulders. I looked in this morning, and the basement is half full of mud and water. It's a total loss," end quote. Sicamous residents using the Mara Lake water system were told not to use their tap water for drinking, cooking, or bathing, even after boiling it. A notice posted to the district's website said the main plumbing system was not in operation and no water was entering the system. The district was handing out water at its offices. All schools in the Sicamous area are closed until further notice. The SPCA in Sicamous has also offered to help residents find emergency boarding for their pets.
Vancouver, well known for being Canada's least affordable city, is looking to undergo change in how low-income and affordable housing is planned, built, occupied, and administered. The city's Housing Affordability Task Force, a broadly based group set up by Mayor Greg Robertson last year, is working to change this and just released a report on how Vancouver can change. The task force, made up of academics, members of the building industry, government, and non-profit housing providers, aims to change all of that. While the group focused on affordability issues for moderate-income households earning between $21,500 and a combined income of $86,500, it also examined issues and pressures facing households earning less than $21,500 per year. The report's recommendations are framed around four broad ideas: increasing supply and demand and diversity of housing, creating agencies to administer and fund that capacity, protecting existing social and affordable rental housing, and lastly, reducing the red tape developers encounter at City Hall. The report will be debated in Council on Tuesday, June 26th, and won't be considered final until the fall, after city staff collate public views on some of the proposals. But in releasing the report to the public on Monday, a number of key things the city can do for affordable housing were outlined. These include: 1. Creating a city-owned housing authority to buy and develop land for social and affordable housing that it would administer. 2. Setting up and putting into a community land trust city land that would be administered by a non-profit corporation. And 3. Forming a, quote, community-based financing agency funded by unions, pension funds, religious organizations, foundations, and others that would offer low-interest construction financing.
The Conservative Party has released their first attack out of the year against new NDP leader Tom Mulcair. Ruling Party uploaded two free ads on YouTube, one English and one in French, apparently content to rely on mainstream and social media to spread the word. These ads come 3 months after Mulcair was chosen to lead the NDP, which was a crucial time lag in which Mulcair has managed to boost his own party into a slim lead over the Tories in opinion polls, as well as burnish his own credentials as would-be Prime Minister. In contrast, the Tories gave Stéphane Dion, Michael Ignatieff virtually no time to introduce themselves on their own terms to Canadians when they were elected to lead the Liberals. At that time, the Conservatives had mounted immediate, expensive, primetime television advertisements that denigrated Dion and Ignatieff, respectively, as not a leader and just visiting. The Conservatives refused to say whether they eventually intend to pay to broadcast the relatively tame anti-Mulcair ads on TV. This delay in going after the NDP suggests that the Tories do not have the same amount of interest in demolishing Mulcair as thoroughly as they did Dion and Ignatieff. Nevertheless, with the NDP now edging into the lead in the polls, the Tories appear to have decided it's time to step up the aggression. These ads are particularly notable for the criticism of Mulcair's support of a cap-and-trade system for carbon, a method that was actually favored by the Tories until recently.
The British Columbia government is planning to ask the public where it would like the coastal ferry service to be cut to save money, said Blair Leckstrom, the province's transportation and infrastructure minister. The government issued a request for proposals on June 19th, seeking a consultant to develop and conduct a public engagement process on ferry service. The intention is to get suggestions from the public on how BC Ferries can reduce its costs by $30 million a year, said Minister Leckstrom. He also said it makes no sense to have sailings at times when there are few passengers, and it might, for example, be a matter of reducing the number of sailings on a hypothetical route from six a day to four, and members of the public may have opinions on which sailings should be kept. The NDP's critic for ferries, Gary Coons, said the consultation is a delaying tactic and noted that the BC Ferry Commissioner, the Auditor General, and the Comptroller General have all reviewed provincial ferry services in recent years. He said the ferry's company problems, with affordability, dropping ridership, and financial losses, are well known, and it's time for the government to act.
A lawyer is filing a class action lawsuit over a recent oil spill in central Alberta. Tony Merchant says the claim is seeking $75 million in damages against Plains Midstream Canada. A section of pipeline owned by the company leaked June 7th near the community of Sundry, spilling up to 475,000 liters of light sour crude into the Red Deer River. High river levels flushed most of the oil downstream into Glenifer Lake, a man-made reservoir and popular recreational area. An Airdrie couple who owns two lots in a nearby RV park are named as plaintiffs in the suit. Suzanne and Darren Rieger claim the spill has decreased the value of their properties. And those were your provincial and national headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick break, but please do stay tuned for your international news as well as your weekday weather forecasts.
Jazz is a word that means many different things to many different people. The best definition of jazz that I know of is the jazz show on CITR with yours truly, Gavin Walker. Monday nights, 9 to midnight, with the jazz feature at 11 o'clock. Check us out every Monday.
Welcome back to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM. It is now time for your weekday weather forecast with the one and only Phil Chang with the UBC Storm Club.
Hi, Phil.
Hi. Hi, guys. Good evening, listeners. Have to say, a gloomy-looking week is coming up. Looks like it will be cloud-cover skies on most nights and days. Some occasional showers will be starting and stopping abruptly throughout, but on average, fortunately, it shouldn't accumulate more than 1 millimeter on any particular day. For summer, it's actually quite a chilly week. The temperature is lingering around 15 degrees on most occasions. Now, here's your five-day weekday weather forecast for UBC. Tonight, overcast, low of 14. Tuesday, overcast with a 60% chance of showers in the morning and in the afternoon. High of 17, low of 13. Wednesday, anticipating partly cloudy morning, then overcast for the rest of the day. High of 17, low of 14. Thursday, overcast with 20% chance of about 1 millimeter of precipitation in the evening. High of 19, low of 11. And Friday, partly cloudy with a 70% chance of about 5 millimeters of precipitation. High of 18, low of 12. So that's your five-day forecast, guys. Gloomy week.
Well, so. Sorry to hear that.
Okay.
Well, thank you so much, Phil.
Yeah, thank you.
Have a good week. And that was Phil Chang from the UBC Storm Club, bringing you your weekday weather forecast. Up next, we have your weekly health segment brought to you by our own health team, Dietitian Intuition.
Happy Monday, Vancouver. This is Jessica Carter for Dietetic Intuition for June 25th. So last week was International Men's Health Week, and a recent study came out that I was alerted to that found the prostate cancer risk and overall death rate for men decreased with increasing serum selenium, which is a certain nutrient found in food. So why are we focusing on prostate cancer? Well, it's the most common cancer experienced by the male population in Canada. 26,000 cases. That's a lot. But the good news is 96% of men survive for at least 5 years after diagnosis. That's about 1 in 7 men who will likely develop prostate cancer in his lifetime. And so steps should be taken to avoid cancer in general. So since there's no one cause of cancer, there is no one surefire way to prevent cancer. But exercising most days of the week and eating a diet rich in plant-based foods and consuming alcohol in moderation, if at all, maximum 2 servings a day for men, is suggested to decrease one's risk of most types of cancer. And another way is to increase antioxidants, which are found in lots of fruits and vegetables, into one's diet. So for men, if you could switch your regular tea for green tea on occasion or increase your fruit and vegetable consumption, that would be all very good things to do. So screening for cancer and prostate cancer specifically, the general consensus that I have found is about age of 40 for men who are considered high risk. These are men who are African American or who have a strong family history of prostate cancer. And it appears that around 50 is the recommended screening age for males who do not have a family history of breast cancer. So if you have any more questions about prostate cancer, your risk, or nutrition advice regarding any cancer in general, a really good source to go is HealthLink BC, and that's a free call. You just dial 811 on any phone, and you are automatically linked to health professionals for free, including a dietitian that specializes in oncology. So that is your Monday Dietetic Intuition for this week. Until next time, Vancouver, stay happy and healthy. This is Jessica Carter for 101.9 CITR. Thank you to Jessica and the whole team over at Dietetics Intuition for letting us know about that today. They'll be back next Monday with another episode, or another segment, I guess, of Dietetics Intuition. So next we go to our international headlines with Free Speech Radio News. And we'll start off with international headlines.
I'm Andrew Stelzer with these headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Celebrating crowds remain in Cairo's Tahrir Square a day after Mohamed Morsi was officially named Egypt's first freely elected president. The Muslim Brotherhood candidate will take the reins of a government mired in chaos. Morsi has pledged to include other non-Islamist parties in his cabinet, but it's still unclear what powers the president will have. Egypt's military council has made recent moves to maintain control over virtually all government decisions, and negotiations over how they will share that power continue. U.S. President Barack Obama called Morsi to congratulate him on the victory and pledged continued U.S. support for Egypt. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said he looks forward to continued cooperation with the Egyptian government. In a speech on Sunday, Morsi says he will respect all international agreements, possibly a veiled reference to a 1979 peace treaty with Israel. Turkey's deputy prime minister says that Syria fired at a second Turkish plane in the past week. This one was a search and rescue plane searching for wreckage of a warplane brought down over the Mediterranean on Friday by Syria's air defenses. This comes as a cadre of top military officers have defected from Syria and taken refuge with their families in Turkey. FSRN's Jacob Resnick has more.
A Syrian foreign ministry spokesman said today that the Turkish reconnaissance jet had come in fast and low, and its air defense gunners reacted automatically when it brought the plane down with machine guns on Friday. The two pilots have yet to be found. Turkey admits its plane strayed into Syrian airspace, but claims it was shot down over international waters. U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton criticized Syria's response, and an emergency meeting of the NATO alliance is scheduled for Tuesday. But despite rising tensions, a military response is unlikely, as Turkey has not invoked the mutual defense clause of the NATO Charter. Syria is known to possess state-of-the-art air defenses, a key deterrent to outside intervention in Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's crackdown of an uprising that's cost an estimated 17,000 lives over the past 16 months. Relations with Turkey were already at historic lows, as Turkey continues to host insurgent Free Syrian Army fighters on its soil and receive military defectors. Turkey's state media reported today that 33 members of the Syrian army, including a general and two colonels, had sought refuge in Turkey with their families, adding to the nearly 33,000 Syrian refugees that have fled to Turkey to escape the fighting. Jacob Resnick, FSRN, Istanbul.
In Sudan, demonstrations against austerity measures and the regime of President Omar al-Bashir continued for the 10th day as the government announced it will not back off a policy of ending fuel subsidies. The protests began among students but have spread to other sectors of the population and to cities besides Khartoum. Police have used tear gas to disperse several demonstrations over the past few days. Videos show demonstrators burning tires and throwing rocks. Opposition political parties, some of whom are hoping for a large-scale rebellion, at least 15 of their members are among hundreds detained or arrested since the demonstrations began. Residents and police clashed in the summer capital of Indian-controlled Kashmir after fire gutted a 200-year-old renowned Sufi Muslim shrine. Shahnawaz Khan reports.
Residents of Srinagar flocked to the shrine of Dastgir Sahib early this morning as soon as the news of the fire spread. Soon after, angry protesters fought with police and firefighters, blaming them for a slow response. Witnesses say the blaze started from the roof after the dawn prayers. The cause of fire was not known immediately. Clashes spread to other localities with protesters chanting pro-freedom slogans. Police said at least 20 people, including 10 policemen, were injured in the clashes. The shrine is believed to house relics of a Sufi saint, Sheikh Abdul Qadir Jilani, popularly known as Dastgir Sahib. It's revered by majority of Muslims in the region and draws visitors across faiths. The local government said all the sacred relics and rare manuscripts in the shrine were safely retrieved and promised its reconstruction. It also ordered an investigation into the causes of the fire. Separatist and religious leaders called for a shutdown on Tuesday to mourn the loss and called for an independent investigation. Shahnawaz Khan, FSRN, Srinagar.
A group of U.S. postal workers began a four-day hunger strike to protest looming cuts to the postal system. It's the culmination of months of protests across the country against plans to reduce service in rural areas, close distribution centers, and end overnight delivery of first-class mail. The demonstrators want Congress to eliminate a unique requirement that the Postal Service maintain a large pension surplus, which they say is responsible for many of the service's financial woes. Protests and rallies are scheduled throughout the week in Washington, D.C. They are also targeting the Washington Post because of numerous editorials by the paper in support of cuts to the Postal Service. And those are today's headlines. For Free Speech Radio News in Oakland, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
In Paraguay, the removal of Fernando Lugo from presidency has drawn condemnation from regional leaders and sparked protests within the country. Lugo, who had one more year in his term, was formally impeached by the Senate on Friday on charges related to a police operation earlier this month to remove peasants from land that led to an estimated 17 deaths. Lugo's election in 2008 ended more than 60 years of rule by the dominant Colorado Party. His vice president, Federico Franco, has assumed power. For more, we're joined by Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. He joins us from Washington, D.C. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you.
How was Lugo removed from the presidency so quickly?
Well, the Congress just did it. They had kind of a kangaroo court kind of trial, which they called impeachment, but it wasn't much of a trial or an impeachment. It lasted 4 hours, and they gave the president's lawyers 2 hours to defend him, and they had only given less than 24 hours to prepare a defense. So there wasn't anything that would resemble due process, which is actually provided for in Article 17 of the Paraguayan Constitution.
You talked about the speed of this process. The impeachment charges came down on Thursday, and then the trial took place on Friday?
Yes.
And what was at the center of the impeachment charges against Lugo?
Well, the main pretext that they used was this confrontation between their last week. There was a land conflict. And 17 people were killed. So they used that, and of course the media there is very much against Lugo, so they somehow tried to make it look like it was his fault, although he didn't have anything to do with it. And they took advantage of this kind of climate of hysteria to move on him.
Land reform is a central issue in Paraguay. How extensive is the problem of land ownership and the disparity there?
Well, it's the worst in the Western Hemisphere from the data that's available, and really probably the worst in the world. It's 1% of total land holdings there are more than 3/4 of the total land.
Lugo had one more year in his term. When he was elected, he ended more than 60 years of rule by the dominant Colorado Party. That was in 2008. What's your assessment of his time in office since then and his ability to address this disparity in land ownership?
Yeah, he hasn't been able to do very much, but the groups that are organizing for land reform and other social movements are still supportive of him. That is a big issue, and the landowners are extremely powerful, and of course, they basically control the Congress.
Well, as you mentioned, despite this lack of progress on this issue, he still maintains support from many of the peasant groups. And after this impeachment announcement came down, we saw protests in the streets and support for him. Talk about the Colorado Party and his vice president, Franco, who now is assuming power, and what their stance is on these issues.
Well, the vice president is from a different party, and he's very much going to support the powerful interests there, including the landowners. And so it's a completely different thing. It's not like a vice president that would take over here. And they just don't want to, I think, open up the space for these social movements to be able to organize. I think that's what they were really afraid of. They were looking ahead, and I guess I'm worried more about repression now at this point. You know, today it was reported that Lugo has called for people to protest peacefully, and that he's formed a shadow cabinet. a shadow government. And so I think it could be dangerous. I mean, this was a country that has been repressive. It's been a dictatorship for, you know, most of the last 70 years. And these institutions that come from the dictatorship are still very much entrenched, including the Colorado Party.
The Organization of American States has expressed concern about Lugo's removal and the way it was done. His removal has also been referred to as a coup by Ecuador, Venezuela, and others in the region. What has the U.S. response been, and what's next in this situation?
Well, the U.S. response has been discouraging because they, you know, at first made a couple of comments about due process, but then since Lugo has been formally removed from office there, they've been quiet. That silence after the removal really sends a strong message. It's similar to what they did in the coup in Honduras in 2009. If you remember, the very first statement that came out of the White House right after the coup was one of the few in the world that didn't condemn the coup. And that is the way they send the message to the people who pulled it off, that we're on your side. They can't say, they can't congratulate them openly. The silence is the way you send that message in diplomatic circles.
Mark Weisbrot is co-director for the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
In Bolivia, a march is underway to protest a controversial plan for a highway that would cut through the Amazon. After a protest last year by indigenous inhabitants of the area where the road is supposed to be built, the project was delayed but not canceled. President Evo Morales said he still plans to build the road. The current march is now on its way to the government seat in La Paz. FSRN's Peter Teffer reports.
After arriving in the small Bolivian town of La Embocada, a group of indigenous people set up their camp and make some music before retiring for the day. The group is part of a 300-mile-long march against the plan for a road through an indigenous territory in the Bolivian Amazon, known by its acronym of TIPNIS. The marchers include indigenous inhabitants of the TIPNIS, but also people from other communities or cities. These marchistas left from the Amazonian city Trinidad at the end of April, and so far have walked around 200 miles. They hope to arrive at the de facto capital of the country, La Paz, later this month. This day they've been marching from San Borjas, a leg of around 13 miles. Along their journey, they chat or listen to the radio. Juana Bejarano is one of the marchers. She's wearing a red cap and is carrying a pole with a figure of Maria. Like most Bolivians, she's of the Catholic faith.
The motive of our march is to defend our territory and its nature. We don't want the government to destroy TIPNIS, which belongs to us.
This is the second march in defense of the TIPNIS within a year. The previous march arrived in La Paz last October. That effort helped to put pressure on the government, which decided that the park would be intangible. Soon after, however, another march occurred of Bolivians who do want the road to be built. The Bolivian government responded with a law that required a consultation process to be held, a sort of referendum. Carlos Cayuba is mayor of Concepción de Ichua, a village in TIPNIS. He says that the consultation process comes too late.
Well, look, after analyzing this with the other local leaders, we concluded this was a false law because the consultation process still had not been held before the contract was signed.
The marchers say they're offended that the government didn't consult them before signing a contract with a Brazilian construction company. This right to prior consultation had in fact been recognized by the same government a couple of years earlier when it introduced a new constitution in 2009.
What they fear is the legal precedent, the right to prior consultation is enshrined in the constitution.
Dario Kenner works for the Bolivian Climate Change Platform, an organization representing various indigenous movements.
There are other indigenous territories titled, they're called deseos, so they're worried that what could happen in the Tipnis, which is an indigenous territory titled. In fact, the title was given to the 64 communities by Evo Morales. They're worried that in their other indigenous territories, which are of a certain amount of hectares and are demarcated, where there are also natural resources in terms of oil, gas, mining, they're worried that the same thing will happen in their territories.
Although the contract with the Brazilian company OAS was cancelled in April, the Bolivian government has repeatedly stated it still wants to build the road. The political forces pushing for this highway are very powerful, says Jim Schultz, the director of the Cochabamba-based Research Institute's Democracy Center.
In one direction you have Brazil, that, you know, up until recently was both financing and essentially building the highway. And they, Brazil says it wants a highway because it wants a better land route to the Pacific. I personally think that's not true. Anybody who's ever dealt with roads in Bolivia knows that there's no such thing as a reliable land route. It just takes one blockade and your trucks aren't going to get through. What they want is access into the Tipnis because they want access into the natural resources, including oil, that exist there that they're already investigating and exploiting. On the other side, you have the coca growers in the Chapare who very much want more land on which to cultivate.
The coca growers are influential because of their connection with President Evo Morales, himself a former coca grower. There has been some confusion about who will be included in the consultation process. If the coca growers that live to the south of the Tipnis area are included, their vote might be decisive. Dario Kenner says the question of who should be consulted is critical.
The ILO Convention 169, the UN Declaration of Rights of Indigenous Peoples, make it very clear that the right to prior consultation is of the communities within that indigenous territory. It's not outside.
The start of the consultation process has been delayed a number of times. It is now set to begin on July the 10th. If all goes well, the Marchesas by then have already reached La Paz. Peter Seffer, FSRN, La Embocada, Bolivia.
In Brazil, delegates wrapped up the UN's Conference on Sustainable Development in Rio de Janeiro by endorsing a resolution that seeks to spur economic growth and launch a new green economy. But text of the final declaration was roundly criticized by civil society groups, environmentalists, indigenous leaders, and others for failing to address poverty and environmental concerns. In Rio, a youth coalition tore up a draft of the text as Canadian Youth Climate Campaign National Director Cam Fenton spoke.
We reject this text because it fails to live up to the promises that were made to us. We were promised leaps and bounds here in Rio, and we've been given a document that barely moves us inches. We reject this text because it is a failure of ambition. It is a failure of vision. We reject this text.
That audio posted on the Guardian website today. Kumi Naidu of Greenpeace also spoke today, saying true negotiations did not take place. He called for more action on pressing issues such as climate change.
We are playing political poker with the future of our planet by not acting with the urgency that the situation calls for. And I think that it is criminal that we have close to 100 heads of state come here and do not spend even 1 hour in negotiations with each other. That the whole process was left to civil servants and diplomats to actually negotiate an agreement with no effort by heads of state to actually say, it's not good enough, we need more ambition, and so on.
During the UN conference, the People's Summit for Social and Environmental Justice created an alternative space for social movements and NGOs critical of the UN process they believe has been co-opted by corporations. Thousands of people representing NGOs and social movements from around the world gathered for the 9-day summit, which also ended today. FSRN Saki Hall reports from Brazil.
Indigenous peoples, trade unions, women's movements, African descendants, and many other groups gathered at the People's Summit to discuss a wide range of issues. The focus of the summit was to develop solutions from a grassroots perspective and create a people's agenda to address the root causes of climate change and inequality. Participant Nokoya Gagushi of the Rural Women's Movement says capitalism is a root cause of the global crisis and criticizes the green economy proposed by world leaders as a solution.
And my reason for being here is to challenge the government and corporations not to come up with false solutions and to say no to this idea of a green economy. That is not real. That is a false solution as well. Economy cannot be green. It's just twisting around capitalism.
Resisting UN programs like RED, reducing emissions from deforestation and forest degradation, has been one of the dominant themes of the summit. RED was developed to mitigate climate change by offering carbon credits to governments or corporations who invest in forest preservation. Opponents argue that it commodifies natural resources and allows corporations to buy their way out of reducing carbon emissions. Clayton Thomas Mueller of the Indigenous Environmental Network says RED also threatens the land rights of indigenous peoples.
What we know is that it's actually just a mechanism for probably the largest land grab in modern history, you know, that aims to privatize, you know, the forested lands of over 66 million indigenous peoples and forest-dependent peoples in the global south, and to turn those forests into commodities to be bought and sold on the International Carbon Facility, the World Bank.
Groups have proposed an alternative: 1 million climate jobs. The campaign is taking root in Britain, South Africa, Zimbabwe, Sweden, Norway, and the United States, among other countries. Treston Davis Faulkner, National Field Director of the U.S.-based organization Jobs with Justice, says demanding that governments create climate jobs is a way to decrease mass unemployment and greenhouse gases.
The whole notion of a 1 million climate jobs campaign is essentially a proposed genuine solution to address the, you know, these economic and ecological crises that we're dealing with.
Another initiative launched at the People's Summit is a campaign to challenge corporate power and end impunity. Richard Girard, research coordinator at the Polaris Institute based in Canada, says the campaign is meant to be a way for current actions against transnational corporations to come together.
We need to create a counter voice and counter kind of power to kind of power that corporations wield over our elected officials and our international institutions.
The People's Summit concludes Friday with a presentation of a position paper that synthesizes ideas generated by grassroots groups. This position paper is intended to guide the global social movements and people struggles for climate justice and equity in the years to come. Sacagawea Hall, FSRN, Rio de Janeiro, Brazil.
Another topic at the Rio Plus 20 conference is the threat rising sea levels poses to small island nations. Kiribati is one of those nations that could be affected, and its president, Anote Tong, told UN Radio's Enrique Macedo more needs to be done to address these environmental challenges.
Our concern has been with climate change, and we have followed the discussions on climate change. In fact, we've advocated very strongly that the international community has got to act on climate change. And of course, sustainable development is very much a part of not doing the right thing. Well, the idea of having sustainable development is so that we can do better in balancing our development aspirations and sustaining the environment. That has failed because the small developing island, most vulnerable countries, will be affected by the impact of climate change already, and certainly much more so into the future. And so we need to make this very strong statement to the international community that as a global community, we have failed. What is happening to us and what will happen to us is something that you don't want to happen to the rest or other countries. And so we want to send this very strong message. Do it right. Otherwise, other countries will also become victims.
How do you see the development of the sustainability plans being brought up in the conference?
Well, as I also said in my statement, with a conference of almost 200 countries involved, it's obviously going to be very complicated. And again, the outcome is not as strong as we would have liked to have seen. But I'm sure for those countries not facing the most immediate concerns about climate change, they might feel it's already too strong. And so I think it really demonstrates the diversity of positions. And I think this is the problem that we constantly face. Even as we try to carry out what we believe sustainable development, we will have different definitions between our different countries. But I think the bottom line is that to be sustainable does not mean that it's sustainable for one country and not the next country. It's got to be sustainable for all, for it to be meaningful. Otherwise, we're not getting anywhere. And only a few countries will remain sustainable, while the rest will pay the ultimate price.
How do you see the development of your own country, and what do you think is happening to your land?
It's not what I think is happening, it's what I see happening that I want to discuss. And I want to tell you that already we are facing a lot of difficulties with disease eroding much of the land. We have communities which have had to be relocated because seawater is coming over. We, in some communities, the salt water has come into the freshwater pond and contaminated the waterlands, and it's affected the food crops. So this is the point that I've always been trying to make, that climate change is not an event of the future. I think in general terms, it may be. But already there are countries which are now feeling the impact of climate change. And so our point, and the point that I've constantly been making, is if we don't, as a global community, deal with this, more countries are going to become victims, as we already have become victims.
That was Kiribati President Anote Tong speaking from Rio about the challenges his country faces from rising sea levels. The Israeli blockade of Gaza has contributed to many hardships for residents in the coastal territory, including a lack of goods, difficulty in accessing health services, contaminated water supplies, and unreliable electricity. But in the midst of these challenges, there are some projects that are giving hope to young Palestinians. FSRN's Rami Almagari reports on how one music school is offering a rare opportunity to its students.
To help me cope with anything.
At the Palestinian Music Institute, 13-year-old Sara Al Najjar performs a song with a band of youth musicians. Al Najjar was born and raised in Gaza, and she began singing when she was 9 at the American school in Gaza. 2 years ago, she transferred here to the Palestinian Music Institute, where she studies singing and guitar. Another student is 9-year-old Leanne Al-Makousi. She has been taking guitar lessons for almost 2 years.
The first thing is that I love guitar very much, and I love when I be older, when I grow up. I want to be like a guitar player.
The institute is funded by the Katan Charitable Foundation, which has a children's center in Gaza. Located in the Tel El Hawa neighborhood, the school's facilities are just 220 square feet. It's a new classroom, as the original facility was destroyed just days after its inaugural public performance during Israel's 3-week-long attack on the Gaza Strip in early 2009. The school offers a range of classes taught by more than a dozen teachers. Ramzi Suleiman is an American-Palestinian musician from Washington, D.C. He is also one of the teachers at the school.
The pupils are good. I can tell that they're really happy to be here. And they're just here hanging out, and they're just talking, and they're just sometimes playing, sometimes picking up instruments. But I can tell that they enjoy being at the school. And the school is a place that they love.
Ramzi is not the only foreign teacher at the music school. There are other nationalities, mainly wives of Gaza-based Palestinians. Among them are Romanians, Ukrainians, and Russians. Another educator is veteran Gaza musician Ibrahim Al Najjar. He serves as the school's academic coordinator.
Pupils here practice and learn music for a couple of days a week. Each student receives one-on-one instruction and takes another class for music theory. Every 40 minutes, each teacher receives one of the 12 students each, according to his or her specialization. We need academic people who are specialized in music.
In addition to singing, guitar, violin, flute, drums, and piano, students are also learning historical Arab instruments like the lute and kanun. 11-year-old student Abdulaziz Abu Sharikh is in his third year of playing the kanun, a traditional Arab musical instrument that dates back centuries. It is made of wood and strings and is strummed in one's lap.
When I play some folkloric Palestinian songs like Wayne Aramallah, Yazarif El Tul, Jadaliya Majadayel. When I play music, I feel happy and my morale increases. My father has always encouraged me to learn music, telling me that he had hoped to learn music when he was a child. When I play music for him, when he is nervous, he feels relieved.
The school recently partnered with the Edward Said National Conservatory of Music at Birzeit University in the West Bank. The collaboration will allow Gaza's institute to offer an 8-year-long musical studies program. Rami Al-Mighari, Free Speech Radio News, Gaza.
Thanks to Free Speech Radio News for bringing us those international headlines. Daily headlines and their full newscast can be found at their website, fsrn.org. We'd also like to throw out a shout-out for FSRN's sponsorship drive. They've got until this Friday, which is June 29th, I believe, to raise $18,300 to meet their total goal of $75,000. So without this, there's actually a good chance that they'll be shut down permanently. So as many of our listeners know, Free Speech Radio News is a fantastic progressive news source that provides great international coverage. So we really encourage listeners to go to fsrn.org, to maybe throw in a few dollars and make sure that this news source doesn't get shut down. So you're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca.
And that's our program for Monday, June 25th. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved, or give us an important news tip, please contact us through our email, news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews and health segments on our website, citr.ca/news. For more independent news, join us on Monday and Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Chirag Mahajan.
And I'm Claire Eagle. Today's show is produced by CJ, and from the entire news team here at CITR, thank you for listening. Stay tuned now for Sore Throats Clapping Hands right here on CITR 101.9 FM.